Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, November 17, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ugandans are on alert after two bomb blasts killed three people in Kampala yesterday.
The hallmarks of the attack clearly indicate that the ADF-linked radicalized groups are behind these attacks because the nature of the bombs they are using.
Sudan's pro-democracy groups plan yet another protest today, Wednesday. Cameroonians plead for tolerance among religions, Francophones, and Anglophones. An exiled Eswatini member of parliament is not deterred by the loss of his parliamentary seat. And Nigerian rights activists are praising a Lagos State report into last year's protest.
The first feeling I had was relief, because I never expected them to be so transparent or be able to say the truth. I thought that they would run away from saying the truth because they were a panel that was set up by government.
And cervical cancer screening for women in Mali. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ugandans are on alert after a pair of suicide bomb attacks just 3 minutes apart hit two high-profile targets in the capital, Kampala, killing three people and injuring scores on Tuesday morning. It was the latest in a series of recent attacks that police say used the same type of bombs, and they are blaming extremists. Police heighten security in the city and ask residents to vacate as they investigate. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
One of the blasts was in the Central Business District, adjacent to the Kampala Central Police Station. The other went off at Parliament Avenue, a few meters away from the Parliament building. Police say three suicide bombers were involved. Three vehicles burst into flames immediately. VOA caught up with some eyewitnesses.
As the blast came, it affected the building from the other side, at the other road side. And we only saw the building. I thought maybe it was shot from afar or the building.
So it exploded from the roadside. Actually, our guard, two of them, they got a serious injury. So I don't know which hospital they have taken them. Actually, I'm still looking for more guards. I'm not seeing them.
33 were confirmed injured, with 7 in critical condition. Some sustained cuts on their heads, hands and stomachs, while others were rushed to Mulago National Referral Hospital Casualty Ward, bleeding profusely or nursing broken limbs. Police blamed domestic terror groups like the ADF. Fred Enanga, the police spokesperson, spoke to reporters.
These attacks come 22 days after the last suicide attack on Usif Safari Bus. The hallmarks of the attack clearly indicate that the ADF-linked radicalized groups who still have a desire to carry out lethal attacks on soft targets using suicide attackers and improvised explosive devices behind these attacks because the nature of the bombs they are using.
Police and local leaders have called on Ugandans to remain vigilant amid concerns of more attacks. Salim Uhuru is the mayor, Kampala Central Division.
And you have seen the area they have chosen are key spots, so which means they're really determined to destroy us as Uganda. Most shops are closed in town. People are scared because of this bomb blast that has happened. So it's very unfortunate, and I condemn it as the mayor, Kampala Central. I condemn such acts because Uganda, we should love Uganda. We should not destroy Uganda.
A number of city roads and buildings have been cordoned off as police and the army continue to search for evidence and other possible explosives. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
In Sudan, pro-democracy groups are planning yet another protest today, Wednesday, to pressure the military to return the country to a civilian-led transition government. This after reports say a U.S. diplomat met Tuesday with ousted Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok in Khartoum about Sudan's democratic transition. Journalist Michael Atit is in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum.
17th of November, it marks the 21 months of the chairmanship of the Sovereign Council that was being chaired by the military, according to the constitutional document or the power-sharing deal. On 17 August 19 between the military and the civilian political forces. Unfortunately, this time is coming when the political situation in the country has already been changed. And according to many Sudanese who actually believe that the reason behind the military takeover in Sudan on October 25th is because they didn't want to hand over the chairmanship of the Sovereign Council to a civilian. So today there will be a lot of protest that has been organized by what so-called resistance committees to repeat the call for military to revert their decision and to allow Sudan to be governed by a democratic civilian rule.
Michael, what can you tell us about the U.S. envoy meeting with former Prime Minister Hamdok in Khartoum?
Up to this moment, there are no leaked information about the meeting of the special envoy with the author of Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok. But definitely, the message is clear. The American government and even the European Union, the African Union, they wanted still to have a peaceful transition of power, a peaceful transition in Sudan, governed or ruled by a civilian rule, so that Sudan is able to, you know, pass through this period of time and go for a national election. Up to now, as I said, there are no leaked information about their meeting, but definitely they should discuss the situation around the country, and maybe they might discuss also whether Hamdok is going to accept the offer of the head of military to return in his position as the prime minister or not. But this is something Hamdok has rejected several times, according to the information to sources. Hamdok said he will only return to his position as the prime minister if all the political detainees are released from the custody and the military are ready to reverse the decision of the military takeover and suspension of some articles of the constitutional document.
What can you tell us about this report that the authorities have released an Al Jazeera bureau chief in Khartoum? That
I cannot confirm whether this is true, but what I can confirm is the Al Jazeera bureau chief has been detained for more than 3 days ago in Khartoum. And yesterday, the group of Sudanese journalists actually organized a peaceful protest demanding the release of all other journalists who have been detained, including the Minister of Information and the former advisor to Prime Minister Hamdok.
That was journalist Michael Atit speaking with us from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. Nigerian human rights activists are praising a Lagos state report into protests last year against a controversial special police unit that ended violently. Days of protest against the special anti-robbery squad, known as SARS, in October 2020 came to a halt when security forces fired on the protesters, leaving at least 12 people dead. The report released on Monday blamed Nigerian security for the deaths, as Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The report described the events of October 20 last year as a massacre, stating that agents of the army and police shot at peaceful protesters as they sang the national anthem and waved the Nigerian flag during the evening rally. The report said there were 48 casualties, including 11 people killed, 4 people missing and presumed dead, and many others injured with gunshot wounds. The military, along with police authorities and the national government, have yet to comment on the report, but its findings contradict the early official position on the incident and corroborate accounts told by many protesters. NSARS activists have praised the report, including Obianoji Iloanya, one of the Abuja protest leaders whose brother was killed by the SARS police unit in 2012.
When I saw it yesterday, I think the first feeling I had was relief, because I never expected them to be so transparent or be able to say the truth I thought that they would run away from saying the truth because they were a panel that was set up by government.
In October last year, Nigerian authorities established investigative panels across 29 out of 36 states in the wake of mass protests against police brutality. They were looking into claims many made by younger citizens of abuse. The Lagos State panel received 255 petitions against the police. The panel's findings also showed that the military prevented medical aid from getting to the injured protesters after the shooting, further exacerbating the impact. In its submission to the Lagos State authorities on Monday, the panel recommended police reforms and sanctions for security agents who took part in the shooting. The panel also said compensation should be paid to victims and that the government must improve its engagement with the youth and publicly apologize to protesters. Last year, Amnesty International said at least 12 protesters were killed at the toll gate and made recommendations similar to those of the panel. Speaking before the report was leaked, Amnesty International spokesperson Sheun Bakare said government usually trivializes these issues.
The government has consistently refused to take our recommendations seriously. Many times they even claim that all that we are saying is absolute lie.
Iloanya says the leaked report triggered sad memories.
I felt anger and then I felt pain and frustration because these were young people that were out on the streets and demanding for better, and they were killed for that. So it's painful thinking about it.
But NSAS activists like Iloanya say the Lagos panel's findings and honesty inspire confidence and hope that it prompts other investigative panels to do the same. In the wake of last year's deadly protests, the government disbanded the SARS unit. Rights groups have said the unit was a symbol of excessive force. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, November 17. Cameroonians marked this year's International Day for Tolerance, November 16, yesterday, with calls for the country's French and English speakers to make more efforts to get along. Hundreds of Cameroonians protested in the capital against what they call growing intolerance, fueling the country's separatist conflict, which has killed more than 3,000 people and displaced over 500,000. Moki Edwin Kizika reports from Yaoundé.
More than 200 people, most of them women, marched in the city center of Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, on Tuesday against what they call growing intolerance in the Central African state. The protesters, marking this year's International Day for Tolerance, sang that there is a growing lack of respect for each other's cultural and religious beliefs. Secretary General of the Council of Imams and Muslim Dignitaries of Cameroon, Adamu Ngamie, took part in the protest.
La communauté musulmane prend chaque instant des efforts.
Ngamie says all Muslims, especially imams, must try to preach interreligious tolerance because it is praised by God in the Holy Quran. He says intolerance is bringing confusion and discord in Cameroon. Cameroon is in dire need of tolerance that will breed cohesion, says Ngamie, and bring back peace to Cameroon. In 2020, the government of Cameroon reported on problems of interreligious intolerance in the Central African state. It cited conflicts between Christian Pentecostal churches and Muslim fundamentalist movements on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria. The report said several clashes resulted in casualties, but gave no further details. Tuesday's protesters noted intolerance in Cameroon spiked in 2017 when Anglophone separatists, complaining of second-class treatment, took up arms against the French-speaking majority state. 22-year-old University of Yaoundé student Annabelle Michou marched in the protest. She says hate speech and propaganda on social media by both separatists and authorities promote intolerance.
We are calling on everybody to join us on board, to build a hate-free Cameroon, to promote social cohesion, to act for peace. Wherever we find ourselves, we have a collective role to play to make Cameroon a better country. There are alternative, non-violent means of saying what we have and using the right channels in order for our call to be heard. And we should also remember we cannot build by destroying. We have to build by making what we have better.
The Cameroon Women's Peace Movement, which has been urging troops and separatists to lay down their arms, organized the protest. Movement member Nicolene Nwenushi Wazi says the separatist conflict would be greatly reduced if Cameroonians learn to tolerate each other.
We need to acknowledge that every human being is a separate entity. And this acknowledgement needs to come from government through enforceable laws against intolerance. Parents should have a communication around tolerance with their children. In schools, children should be able to know about tolerance. We should be able to promote tolerance.
In July, Cameroon launched a campaign against what it called growing online hate speech, intolerance and xenophobic statements. Rights groups, however, note that along with xenophobic statements, authorities also define hate speech as criticism of the state and longtime President Paul Biya. The government did not issue any statements for this year's International Day for Tolerance, but has in the past called on all Cameroonians to live together in harmony. Cameroon's separatist conflict has claimed more than 3,000 lives and displaced more than 550,000, according to the United Nations. Moki Edwin Kinzaka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Eswatini Member of Parliament Mduduzi Simelani, who has been in self-imposed exile after being declared a fugitive by the government, says he will continue to fight for democracy in his country. This comes after his seat in Parliament was declared vacant on Tuesday for failure to attend Parliament in the last 20 days. The government says his absence is a violation of the Eswatini Constitution. Simelani went into hiding after the government accused him and two other members of Parliament for acts of criminality for their role in the pro-democracy protests. The other two members remain in jail. Simelani says declaring his seat vacant will not deter him.
My brother, this is not a surprise to me. I expected that they will act this way. This regime is really predictable in many forms. They have been threatening me for quite some time. As a matter of fact, I expected this to happen a long time ago. However, this will not kill the spirit of our people. It gives us confidence and inspiration to pursue the freedom that we are crying for and what service needs so much, my brother.
The government says that you have not attended Parliament for the last 20 days, something they say is a violation of the Eswatini Constitution.
Maybe I should answer this question with another question. How to really respect a constitution which is never respected by the monarchy and the government. Take, for instance, the name of the country was changed from Swaziland to Eswatini by the king alone. He did not follow the provisions of the constitution. His own daughter, who is the minister for ICT, last year she disappeared for close to a year. She was never suspended. She remained on full pay. In Parliament with laws and standing orders, however, these are constantly infringed by the monarchy and the government. I've tried to join the session in Parliament virtually, which is allowed. So all I want to say, my brother, is that I stood in Parliament on behalf of the people I represent. I did exactly that. You know, I did no wrong. But I received vital information that my life was in danger. I had to protect myself. I am not on holiday here, but I'm saving myself from being killed by the regime.
Do you have any evidence or proof that the Eswatini government is trying to kill you, as you said?
Maybe I should state that over 80 of our people have died through the barrel of the gun. They have been killed by the army of Swaziland. I got tangible evidence that the regime wanted to assassinate me. That is the reason why I had to run for my life. But what can you expect if these people have the guts to kill literally over 80 of our people? At the end of the day, they go to the international media and say the people of Swaziland have been killed by mercenaries who were hired by those who are advocating for change.
Mr. Simelane, you are in self-imposed exile. How far are you willing to go in the name of democracy?
My brother, let me say that the first part of the question says to me that somewhere you have been misinformed. If you knew the situation in Swaziland, the threat to life, I don't think you will be phrasing it as a self-imposed exile. The self-imposed has a suggestion of the fact that there's nothing wrong in that country. It means I simply decided to leave my country, my home, my wife, my children, my entire family, and my people. This is not self-exile per se. This is forced exile because of the brutal regime that is lawless. We have a constitution that allows us to assemble, to petition the government, to air our views, but the regime seems to think that we should be arrested, not because law enforcement officers suggested it, but this is more of a political issue. We are faced with a monster which does not follow the guidelines of the legal framework in the country.
Mr. Simelane, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you so much, leadership. God bless you.
Mduduzi Simelane is an Eswatini member of parliament who is in self-imposed exile. During the month of October, the Malian health authorities, along with Doctors Without Borders, worked to increase breast and cervical cancer screenings in the capital, Bamako. MSF Oncology Coordinator Alice Othio tells Rekish Trier that access to these screenings has for years been difficult for women in Mali.
The first challenge is about everything is centered here in Bamako, but also there is many women here in Bamako, so that can be the first challenge. And also the second challenge is about having midwives ready and trained to do that screening. So MSF, we are here in support of the Ministry of Health in Bamako in order to train the midwives and also getting all the medical needs for them to do the screening. And I would say the third, but last but not least, maybe, is that the women, they are not all really aware about that issue. So, and even if they're aware, and even if it's free, they might have fears to be screened. So there is a lot of work about sensibilization and raising awareness or educational activities.
How hard is it for women who, for instance, maybe have informal jobs or just, you know, they depend on their daily wages to in order to live, in order, you know, just that simple fact of having to take the time off to go to the screenings, is that a hurdle?
Yes, it is. Of course, it is. Well, a health center, even if it's free there. So in Bamako, it's kind of okay. You have 60 community health centers here in Bamako, so that's quite a lot. So usually, women doesn't have to go too far to go to a health center to be screened. But the most hurdle will be after that, if those women have something positive, for instance, for for cervical cancer, or if they have something in the breast, they have to go to do complementary exams. And that can be an hurdle. And that's why MSF, we set up a program with the Ministry of Health in order to take all those complementary exams in charge.
That was Alice Othio, MSF Oncology Coordinator in Mali. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Bamako, Mali. And that's it for this Wednesday, November 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you will have a good day.